Welcome to This Is Not About Your Body, a body neutrality podcast where we talk about all the real shit body image issues are actually about because they're never just about the way you look. I'm your host, Jesse Nealand, and today I have with me Jessica McGuire, a physiotherapist and creator of the Nervous System School, who teaches people to repair the nervous system using the vagus nerve. Which we will talk about if you don't know what that is. Jessica, who is known as repairing_the_nervous_system on Instagram, gave a TEDx talk called How Play Can Heal Your Nervous System. And she has a book coming out in August called The Nervous System Reset that I'm very excited about. And one of the things I really love about her work is both personally and with my own clients, I've seen how valuable it can be to understand the nervous system when it comes to healing trauma and forming a more neutral or positive relationship with our bodies. And that kind of information and language has been slowly becoming more mainstream in the wellness world, which is awesome, but also a little frustrating sometimes because it can be very easy to talk about these concepts, which are intended to help us feel calmer and more grounded in our bodies in a way that actually creates more fear and more stress. So I love Jessica's work so damn much because she talks about and teaches this super important information in a way that I think feels genuinely safe, empowering, and liberating. So that's why I'm really excited to have her on here today to talk about all things nervous system, regulation, and vagus nerve. So welcome, Jessica.
Thank you, Jesse. I'm so excited to be here with you.
Okay, so I'm going to have you start by defining some basics, and we might be doing a bunch of that during this episode. But just to get everybody on the same page, what is the nervous system and what does it mean to heal or repair it?
It's a great question, and I'm really glad that we're starting here because we're hearing, as you said, more and more about it. And I think it can be a little bit confusing as to what we're talking about. If we zoom right out, we can say that the nervous system actually encompasses a few things. We can have our central nervous system, which is the brain and the spinal cord. And we can, what we're mostly referring to when it comes to stress and trauma is the autonomic nervous system. And technically this falls under this category of the peripheral nervous system. Now, it bugs me because we can't, you know, science and medicine love to partition and separate. Yeah. But when you actually look at the anatomy, you can't separate and have this central nervous system and this peripheral nervous system because they're working more like a feedback loop, you know, brain to body. And this is where the vagus nerve comes in. But when we look at the autonomic nervous system, it used to be so simply defined as like the sympathetic branch, which was like the accelerator, you know, speeds us up. And you can think about this as traveling down and out from the spine into our body, to our different organs. And it's, yeah, like what helps us to mobilize energy. And it bugs me again, Jesse, because it gets a bad rap. There's a lot of things where I go,
I love it.
Really true though. So when we look at it, it has been sort of demonized as this, when we're stressed or, you know, we hear like cortisol gets a bad rap all the time, but all that cortisol is doing is mobilizing glucose so that our brain body system has energy. That's it. Yeah. You know, it is involved when we're under stress, but this mobilization of both our brain and the autonomic nervous system, which I'll call the brain body system because I don't like to separate them. Mm-hmm. That is this amazing capacity that we have to meet challenges, face demands, and recover again. So that's one part of our nervous system. And then we used to just look at this other branch called the parasympathetic nervous system, which was like the brake to slow us down. And it also has fallen under rest and digest. But the amazing work by Dr. Stephen Hodges has shown us that we actually have two brakes. And we can think of this like, you know, we're in the car, we put the gas down with our foot, that's our sympathetic nervous system state. The brake that slows us down is part of the vagus nerve that runs between the brainstem and our heart. And this would be like if we put our foot down and we slow down just so we could match what's happening, like the road that we're on, if you like. And that's very accurate because it's covered in this coating called myelin, which is like electrical insulation covering, if you like. So it makes the messages travel quickly and accurately. And this is a part of our nervous system we can work with so that we learn to match what's happening in our environment with the right speed, if you like, as to what the situation requires. Sure. But what Stephen Porges's work found was that there is actually a third part. And I like to think of this as if you pulled the handbrake on, you know, like say you want to come to a complete stop.
Yeah.
And that's the branch of the vagus nerve that runs from the brainstem right down into our gut. And that's called the dorsal vagal branch. Now, it takes us into a state of what we might call immobilization, shutdown, collapse, mm-hmm. freeze, which in the face of adversity can be extremely helpful because right. it can help us to raise our pain threshold. It can protect us psychologically from experiencing yeah. emotional distress. But what we tend to see is that sometimes people get stuck in that as their default and they spend a long time in this state experiencing, yeah. you know, exhaustion, depression, feeling like they just can't get motivated. Mm-hmm. But that state as well, it's not bad. There's no good or bad parts of our nervous system. It's how we can move between. So if we think about the sympathetic state as the gas, as the accelerator, depending on where you live,
yeah.
that mobilizes us. And we can say that would be like hyper arousal when we're stressed. Yeah. We respond with maybe too much.
Like fight or flight.
Exactly, yeah. exactly. The branch that takes us into, or is the branch that's our foot brake pedal and runs from the brainstem to our heart's pacemaker, that takes us to the ventral vagal state, or we can just say we're regulated. Mm-hmm. And then the other state takes us into that collapse, but also, you know, there's actually good parts of that state too that has to yeah. do with our health. So that's it in a bit of a nutshell. I hope that answers your first question well.
It does. Tell me if I'm getting this correctly in like an maybe oversimplifying, but essentially we have three different parts that sort of are representative of the three different states, one being like amped, one being kind of low and down, and one being regulated. And if that's correct, then I would say a lot of what is happening in wellness culture right now as a response to like trauma and this kind of stuff getting put into the mainstream, but only in like bits and pieces, is that there is judgment of the first two or of the high and the low, right? It's like we always want to be grounded, almost like there's something wrong with you if you're not grounded and you need to fix it. But it would be completely inappropriate to be grounded if like a bear was chasing you. Or, you know, you were getting like actively crushed under something. Like there are reasons that these exist. They're not bad. They're just, you want to have access to all three in balance appropriately.
Exactly. Yeah? And I find it really, I'm against generalizing and simplifying. Mm-hmm. I like complexity. I like nuance. It's just how I work.
I get it. Yeah.
And I like shades of gray. I like when it's not. Like it's like, well, maybe this can be the case in these mm-hmm. instances, but that's not always the case. And mm-hmm. I know that our students sometimes find that I'm not giving them the simple, easy answer. Sure. I don't think that leads to learning and particularly learning about ourselves. So what you're saying is exactly right. And I would say there is this message that we should be calm all the time, but mm-hmm. what I think is the actual message, if we want to live well, have balance in our systems and also have good relationships, is that we have a efficiency of our vagus nerve that can either release its mm-hmm. break and let mobilizing energy in so we can meet that demand.
Yeah.
And it can also slow us down enough to recover from and cope with stress, as well as being able to move between all those different states with the flexibility to match exactly what's happening. So as you said, if someone is aggressive and you're walking along at nighttime and they come up to you and you're like, oh my God, I've got to get out of here, run, you're ready to go.
Yeah.
Likewise, if you are doing a yin yoga class and you've dropped right down into mm-hmm. that stillness and that immobilization where it's safe to be immobilized, that's a beautiful thing too. So it's having this it's almost like they're paint colors, and we want to be able to use them all to paint this picture rather than just using one or two.
So when we're talking about a healed or repaired nervous system, what are we really talking about then? Moving from what to that flexible space?
Yeah. So when we look at this from the autonomic nervous system, what happens is we tend to learn from our experiences. And again, this has to do with the brain as well. So it's not, you know, social media saying it's all about the body or it's all about the brain. Yeah. It's not, it's both. So when we look at, for instance, we have a situation in our life that was highly stressful, our survival brain, which is the lowest part of the brain, it learns implicitly. Now, this means, for instance, if I said to you, so Jesse, can you remember the first time you rode your push bike and you took the training wheels off? And it might be really, really, really young, but you probably could get an image of where you were, who you were with, what your bike looked like. That memory is what we call explicit. So it's like a picture that might come to your mind. It's part of a story. It could be like, yeah, if I said, what was your favorite holiday? You know, sure, you can remember. Yeah. But an implicit memory is the fact that today you could just jump on a bike and ride it without having to think about it, right? Your body knows how to do it. It's the same as, like, say, speaking another language, playing the piano. It's an implicit learning. So when it comes to our survival responses, it's very sensible that we have learnt implicitly because it saves us time without having to think things through consciously. But what happens is that the nervous system and the brain get shaped by our experiences, like relationships, difficulties and traumatic experiences. And then it's almost like they say, well, you know, I'm not going to let that happen again, so I'll respond in the same way. And so what we see is that people who are experiencing chronic and traumatic stress, you know, I said we mobilize this energy to meet demands and then we recover back to a set point. Well, what happens is that there isn't the recovery. And so instead of coming back down to that set point, if another stressor comes in or there's still an ongoing, you know, traumatic event or environment, we will move to a new set point. And that's where our vagus nerve isn't working as well to keep a brake on our physiology. It's a little bit like if you were riding a bicycle downhill and you keep your fingers engaged on the brake just a little bit so that you didn't go too fast. That's actually what the vagus nerve is doing to us all the time. And it just releases so we can rise to the occasion, we can meet demands, or we can move into fight or flight if that's appropriate. So what tends to happen is if the vagus nerve isn't having that braking effect, we might say we have low vagal tone, which is associated with things like chronic illnesses. It's associated with, it can impact on our psychological health too. But the beauty of this system is that we can retrain it. We can exercise our vagal brake, but we can also work with our implicit memory systems as well. So that, say, if we were triggered by something, let's say as a child, a dog bit you, and now you see a dog and you have this adverse reaction, we can train our system in that moment to experience something new. It's not about cognitively thinking about it. It's really an embodied experiential learning. And we will change that. And that is the power of neuroplasticity, which is this capacity we have to reorganize, regrow neural connections. And I think that's such an amazing thing because we have this agency and empowerment to do that when we understand the framework of our nervous system to say, okay, I'm moving into this state. And then using things that help us to learn in a new way.
So I want to name for anyone listening that this is the reason that a lot of people, I feel like because psychotherapy became much more popular before this and for a long time had a lot of time to kind of like be how we imagine our brains and bodies working, we learned to think of fears and stuff as cognitive issues, that we could outthink them. And with body image, this is constantly the thing. Like, I've tried every positive mantra in the world and I still hate my body. What's going on? I must just be stupid or weak or broken or whatever it is. But you're talking about why that is. It's because the problem doesn't live in the explicit. It lives in the implicit, which is where this work comes in and why it's so powerful.
You summarized that so beautifully, Jesse. I could not agree more. And I think when we're looking at ongoing patterns and behaviors that we or other people might have, it's a little bit like an iceberg. Like, we're seeing on the surface things like, it could be, you know, like anything that you're relating to with body image. But for the patients that I used to work with, there was pain, there was insomnia, there was gut issues.
Yeah.
But the emotional component of it was needing to come under the surface of the water and look at, well, what's actually happening with the implicit memory system?
Yeah.
How are people getting triggered? What's happening with the vagus nerve? But this is just having a bigger understanding now that, you know, really looks at the biological, the psychological, and the social, rather than, you know, as I've said before, many, depending on where somebody works, they might just pick one part of that. And that's not really helpful for people with ongoing chronic patterns, behaviors, conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. So with this iceberg imagery, give me some more examples of what's above the water when it comes to like behavior, relationships, thoughts, or feelings. Because I think a lot of people can probably relate to sort of chronic pain stuff, migraines, you know, like you were saying, insomnia. Those are things that we can see physically. But what else lives in that space in terms of thoughts, feelings, and behaviors?
Yeah.
Things are dysregulated underneath.
Yes. So if we look on, we're looking above the surface of the water, and if we look on one side, we can imagine that the on button is stuck on, say, then we have that mobilization. So in that way, what we might feel in our body is a sense of urgency. Like, I need to go faster. I need to do more quick. There's not enough time, hurry.
Yeah.
There's a lot of perfectionism that creeps in here because it's a strategy to help us avoid pain or criticism. Mm-hmm. We might feel, you know, that ongoing anxiety, but it could also be irritation, anger, depending on if it's fight or flight. Definitely insomnia is a really good indication of spending prolonged amounts of period in that state of mobilization. But relationships is really interesting. I think they are such a window into the nervous system. And, you know, like, nobody's perfect here. Hey, like, I think we need to not, this isn't about sitting here going, you shouldn't be saying that, because I snap at my husband when I'm in that sympathetic state too. So really there's a agitation, and we might find ourselves almost like starting arguments and interrupting, criticizing, blaming, and then we might see ourselves storming off. You know, it's that real, I can't believe that they're right. And then that would fit the profile of that hyper arousal. And if we're talking, you know, days and weeks, we're not saying if it happens once in a while. And then on the other side, we can imagine that the off button is jammed, you know, so we're stuck on off.
Mm-hmm.
And really, this is just where people cannot get the motivation to do things. And it was like what you said, Jesse, we can use these cognitive strategies of, if I just get my mindset right, then I'll be able to get the work done. But our physiology is way more powerful than what our mental or the ways that we might try to manage things from a top-down, you know, thinking about it way. So really what we might see is like there's extreme procrastination, apathy, fogginess and forgetfulness.
Yeah.
Just this feeling of hopelessness as well, like it's no use. And if you listen to when people speak in this state, that's the messaging that we're likely to hear is like, well, I've tried that. It just never works out for me. Like
Self-defeating or whatever.
Definitely becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy of, you know, it never works out for me. And in relationships, there's more of this isolating, stonewalling, not texting people back, you know, not wanting to go to social events. So there's the possibility of being stuck on or off. And for some people, they actually oscillate between the two.
I was literally about to be like, this isn't anywhere in my questions, but tell me how come these are the two sort of options so many people, myself included, feel like we're just like popcorning back and forth.
Yeah. So what you might say is that if we think about this, the first way that we might try and deal with a stressor or a challenge in our life is to mobilize. And then it's almost like if we're doing that for days and weeks, it's like we exhaust that system. And then we might drop down into the more of a shutdown.
Yeah.
So there's that way of it happening. But I think if we've learned in the past through traumatic events there's this thing around trauma that's hard to actually say how we define what it is because it's very subjective, you know. Yeah. what I might find traumatic, you might not find traumatic. It really depends on, you know, genetics, values, if we've experienced something similar to that before. But if, for instance, we had a parent that was incredibly critical, and say at first we were like wanting to do something or get their attention and move towards connection, and there was fear around that, and then they were really angry towards us, and we had to collapse back down, we might have learned that, okay, here's a challenge, here's the mobilization, I've got to shrink back down. That can happen, that can create that oscillating pattern as well. But it can be a challenging one to move out of. I find that a lot of people are scared of the, you know, when they're in that collapse and there's a lack of mobilization, they're almost scared to let in the mobilizing energy that will bring them out of that. Anger is a perfect thing. Like, say people who are scared of anger, and it's a healthy thing to have come up, they'll drop down into that freeze or dissociation. So it's like, well, I could come out of this, but oh, that fight or flight energy is so strong now. Yeah. But that's actually a sign that we're moving in the right direction sometimes if we do experience that.
I'm like a big fan of anger. I'm anger's biggest fan for this reason, as well as many others. But yeah, it absolutely is. It feels, I think, for some people, like coming back to life. To be able to tap into it for the first time after a long time of just apathy or shame is like the first sign. It's like your pilot light just got relit.
Exactly. And it's not, I think what has happened is there's been such a like good, bad emotions. And it's like anger's put down as a bad emotion. So it's like, well, I shouldn't be experiencing that. And this is what we know now is that, you know, emotions aren't experienced in one part of the brain. It's not like we have this little part here that says, this is where anger is. We know now that emotions come from the sensations in our body, how they're relayed up to the brain, but it incorporates several areas in a network. And a part of that is the frontal lobe and how we appraise what's happening.
Yeah.
So the way we judge our emotions changes how we experience them.
Totally. Also, I feel like just being able to say, like, even if you're not specifically angry at someone, to go from like a traumatic event that kind of shut you down, like, I don't know why I bother, or I'm never going to bother again because that went horribly. There's a lot of shaminess in that. If you're able to say that shouldn't have happened to me. Or, you know, like when something has violated you in that kind of way and you're just holding it like, I guess I deserved it. there's really nowhere to go. There's no energy to do anything about it with. You may as well just stay frozen, right? Like, what else? There's no point. But as soon as you're able to say that shouldn't have happened to me and get angry on your own behalf in that like protective way, you are immediately unfrozen and immediately have so much more of this access. What I want to know, because I haven't asked you to like actually define the vagus nerve, but what is happening in a moment like that? Because that does seem like it kind of comes from the cognitive place, but clearly something's going on.
Yeah.
In the physiological place.
Totally. It's such a good point. And I love this topic because just working with so many people who experienced a chronic shutdown, it was like switching from there's something wrong with me to there's something wrong with this situation.
Yes.
That is a huge difference to make. But what I would say is going on there. So if we're thinking about being in a state and we're so far down in it, like that shutdown is like a shame spiral, you know, you spiral all the way down. And people say it feels like being in a dark room on your own. Like there's this lack of connection and belonging. And I think the first part is that when we're really down in it, there's a lot, we lack that cognitive aspect to be able to reappraise, because a lot of those areas in our brain we don't have access to. We're primarily working with the activities in the survival brain, you know, that lower part down. Yeah. But as we start to come out, and this is why, you know, it can be from somebody who provides a sense of co-regulation that can help us in this time. As we're coming out, we'll start to have, you know, it's like going from the room being fuzzy in this state to like, okay, the room's starting to become clear. I can actually connect with the environment now. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to connect with my body. And often if we can say, when we understand our nervous system and we say, ah, oh, this is that shame that's associated with this state.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So here's the shame. What's the story? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've got cognitive stories, but we also have body narratives as well. And, you know, this is where I think the juice is if we want to work with old stuff. So as we start to get that awareness of how these things show up when we're in these states and we see the pattern, we're not in it. We've sort of like created this separation, like there's a bit of space and we can go, okay, wow, that's what's actually happening. And then that's where there becomes room to really say, well, is that story actually true? Like we stop internalizing it. But the thing that I realize is that unless we have some awareness of these states, we can't appraise or reappraise. We can't have space. We're just in it, you know? And that's the difference of there's something wrong with me, I'm broken, I'm not enough, as opposed to, wow, my nervous system is really responding in this way. And once we have that space, then we can lean into things like, well, maybe I can see this in a different way, because the information that's coming up from our body is being communicated via the vagus nerve to the survival brain. And it's relying on strong sensory information to tell us how it's doing, which can be, you know, the tension in our shoulders, or for, okay, let's say for this state of collapse, the chest sinks, the shoulders round, the head drops, there's that like dropping of energy coming down, and then that hollow ache of shame. And for a lot of people, they might say it's like a sense of doom, you know, like that something really bad is happening. Well, that messaging up to the brain, that's driving cognitive distortions. That's driving how we're seeing a situation. But if we change those messages coming up to the brain from the body, those stories are naturally going to be different. Yeah. So whilst we have such an emphasis on top down, you know, like changing our thoughts, it's really, if we start in the body, we're tapping into the survival brain, as where our thoughts and thinking is coming from that outer cortex. So yeah, it's a complex answer, but it really is about having a space to reappraise and not being caught in the story.
Do you know what I think is super interesting about this too is like, because our nervous system state impacts what we think, what we feel, what we think about how we feel, all kinds of stuff, right? But that's like how we think of our reality and our consciousness. Without an understanding or an awareness of what's going on physiologically, it is very easy to just feel like a crazy person when this stuff is coming up. And you're like, well, yesterday I thought things were fine, and today everything's obviously, you know, absolutely terrifying. And if you don't have a reason to explain how that same reality, the relationship or the way you look or whatever it is, could change so much, it's very easy to conclude that, like, I guess I am an idiot or I am an unreliable source of information. And I mean, if we had all learned in school that your nervous system state impacts how you think and feel, like, it, this would just be instant, right? We would be like, oh, I wonder what's going on. It would be so immediately validating and soothing. But then when you feel like a crazy person, your stress is more likely to skyrocket, or everything is going to get scarier because you're like, well, now I don't even know if I can trust myself. I don't know what's going on, you know? So it does this horrible spiral that can be cut off at the legs if you just are able to say, oh, I'm dysregulated. So my thoughts right now are following that. They're just doing what they're doing inside of this state. That makes sense.
Exactly. It's almost like, imagine you're walking through a forest and you have never been there before and you have no map and you're trying to find your way to get somewhere. But if you have this map that's got guide rails that says, yes, okay, this is what's happening. Mm-hmm. You're heading this way right now. Let's take you more towards regulation by going this way. You know, we can keep gently coaxing our nervous system back towards the way it should go. But I would just say for people, you know, this isn't just to how we feel. Like, some of the posts this week in the discussions, like I put up one about, you know, how we judge people that move into immobilization who do collapse.
Yeah.
Because we don't understand it as a society. It's right. Poorly understood. And so the comments in that were, for one woman said, yeah, I haven't been able to start my business because I don't want to put myself out there, because she doesn't want to be seen, because that is exactly what that immobilization state is about. Collapse, hide, shame, don't be seen. And then it's the relational aspect. You know, I mean, the fear of connection, this state of collapse, in a way it dates back to that shame was thought to be there to keep us in line with pro-social behaviors, so we belong to the tribe.
Right.
There's, you know, this whole thing around putting ourselves out there, around connecting with other people, that is so powerful. It's really about reaching your potential and having meaningful relationships. I mean, to me, they're the two most important things. So to have this, if we don't have an understanding of it, it plays out without us knowing how it's impacting on us. And just like going through that forest, we can't find our way to get back to regulation.
Absolutely. I also feel like with the question of like, why is mental illness, you know, skyrocketing, depression, anxiety, all these things, you know, in recent history, I just feel like we were never meant to know so many people, to be exposed to so many people's opinions or thoughts, like to be connected to so many essentially like different tribes, as it were. Like that was not part of what we were sort of wired for. And so the thought of putting yourself out there when you only know 30 people and you're pretty sure how they'll respond to you is so different than putting yourself out there for millions, because it's on the internet and now it's a business and people of every imaginable community are going to have access to it. It is so, so different and takes so much more. And I feel like just makes it so much more important that we are able to work, able to have this awareness of what's going on with our nervous systems.
Yeah. Social media. Hey, I mean, that was I remember a few years ago, it was a big thing around like the fear I had about sharing this work. And it was this push pull, you know, I know it's so important to put it out there, but oh my gosh, people are going to criticize me.
Yeah.
You know, that's changed with saying things like understanding that this work is bigger than me now, you know, so it's not really about me. But what I think ties in really beautifully to this is that our sense of self is what our nervous system is really trying to protect, you know, and this ties in with our sense of self comes from a dynamic process of what we feel in our body and also to do with certain regions in the brain, but mostly a lot of this is the arousal in our nervous system too. And so if social media to me is really about there is a vulnerability to the sense of self, if we're putting forward things where we can be attacked, we can be rejected, we can be canceled, which is the ultimate, you know, rejection from the tribe. So if people are listening and finding it scary to share their work, it's understandable. However, there are also ways to work with your nervous system so that you're not being held back from doing the things that are important to you. But yes, I think it's definitely changed how, you know, we are putting our sense of self forward.
So I want to have you talk a little bit more about the sense of self thing, because I know that you talked when we chatted before recording about the connection to interception and sense of self. And I wanted to have you talk about that. And I feel like you just kind of led us right into it. So what, when you talk about it protecting the sense of self and also almost being the sense of self, is this information coming from the body? What do you mean by that? Like, where is it coming from? How does that work?
Oh, it's such a good question. And I'm totally going to nerd out here, Jessie.
Love it.
just pull me back if you need me to.
Okay, great.
So, you know, we know our five senses, like sight, smell, taste, touch, and sound. We actually have three others. So our sixth sense, we can think of as knowing the position, joint position of our body in space. You know, I can close my eyes and touch my nose. So we call that proprioception. And then we have our vestibular system to do with our position and orientation of our head and balance in space as well. But the eighth sensory system, which we haven't, it hasn't really come out into the mainstream yet, but there's a lot of amazing research here, is called interoception. So thinking of in being inside the body. And this is how this is really how we read and understand our internal bodily cues. And it's the foundation of our emotional health and being able to proactively take care of our emotions. But at the same time, it's also linked to homeostasis, or the balance of our systems, because what happens is some information comes up to the lower parts of our brain, and it might be giving information about changes in our blood pressure. You know, we move from to standing state, and we're not aware of it. You know, it's like, it's not entering our conscious awareness, but then the brain will send a message down to keep that balance in our brain body system. We could say though, some of that information does reach consciousness. So it comes up to a little bit higher in the brain, and let's say it's a signal of thirst, you know, like I haven't drank any water today. And then the message that comes back down could be, okay, I'm going to go and get a drink. You know, it's as simple as that. But when we look at this from a physiological point of view and an emotional point of view, those physical sensations are the foundations of our emotions. So if you were to say, we've spoken about anger, how do I know that an emotion is anger? And I think this is where people struggle. This is why it's hard to have this connection to our real and true emotions and allow ourselves to have them. If I was angry, I might notice, well, my heart's beating faster and I can feel like mobilization, you know, like that go, that sympathetic charge. But that could also be the same for excitement. That could be the same for anxiety. And so I really need to be able to understand these bodily signals. Like, okay, well, with anger, I also have a clenched jaw and I feel heat and tension. So rather than just saying I'm angry or I'm stressed, or, you know, it's like getting granular to what is happening in the body, so that we have more insight to those emotions. And there's really good research to show that that emotional granularity is linked to what we call interoceptive accuracy. So we can be really accurate with reading our internal bodily signals. And this is important for a number of reasons, but what has been shown is that people with depression or tend to be on that flatter side, they really struggle to notice bodily signals. Mm. So it's almost like there's this emotional numbness. And then if you think about it, you would have to rely on all cognitive strategies, thinking through everything, rather than just going, that's what I know I need to do. You know, there's a confidence and a clarity that comes with bodily signals. Now, people who are more on the anxious side, that it's been shown that there is an increase in activity between the region in the brain that registers these bodily signals and the fear circuitry in the brain. So what it means is that, say, the heart's beating faster, this comes up and we go, oh, something bad's going to happen. And then we have an activation of anxiety. So interoception is one of those things where too much can mean that we, like if we were getting all the bodily's information about changes in blood pressure and our digestion, we just wouldn't be, it'd be too noisy.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, we can have where we can't read signals enough or can't process them. But what we can learn to do is to improve our interoceptive accuracy so that we read what's happening and use it as the foundation to take care of our nervous system and our emotions as well. So it helps us to proactively take care of them. But, you know, it's like the vagus nerve is sending so many signals from the gut up to the brain. We can also see it with the heart to the brain with things like heart rate variability and signals. And it's such important messages that we have not really, you know, in mainstream heard that much about.
Yeah. So I love this topic so much. Thank you for geeking out. I actually, one of the first programs that I ever created, Self-Study Things, is called Make Friends with Your Feelings. And it's like all about this, because I just immediately, when I started working with clients in this capacity, was like, this is a skill nobody has and everybody needs. It's still on my website. Like it's old, but I stand by it. It's pretty basic, I think, in terms of these skills, but just figuring out like that you have emotions that are distinct, that the language you use to describe them matters and changes the experience, and that you can learn how to differentiate and be more granular and improve pretty much everything in your life is just like magic to me. I think it's so incredible. And I feel like when I'm hearing you talk about that, I'm realizing, and I definitely didn't think about it back then, but I almost feel like it's more for people who are on that shutdown side, because it's, I think who I was working with at the time, the reason that I was inspired to make it was that so many people couldn't sort through, couldn't feel. And as I know, you know, so many people who have body image issues are completely disconnected. Like there's no information, not everyone, plenty of people are on the other side too. But that's a really common experience to be like, I don't know what I feel. I don't know what I need. I don't know what self-care looks like. I don't know if I'm hungry or full. I don't know if I'm tired or mad. Like it's just absolute chaos. And just to have some of those basic skills is life-changing for people.
I totally agree. And kudos to you for putting something together and knowing that's what was the missing piece, because, you know, it's coming out in science, but to know that that was already what people needed, I just think that's amazing that you had that wisdom. But for what you've said around the not being able to connect to the body, there's actually a lot of, unfortunately, associations. Now, it doesn't say that low interoception causes these things, but it's associated with things like irritable bowel syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
It's looking at pain conditions and eating disorders. So we're changing, it's not just emotions, it's feedback loops between the body that govern our health and how we process sensations. I mean, IBS, we used to think was all about having food allergies.
Yeah.
It's not the case. It's more to do with how we process sensations. pain, how we process sensations.
Yeah.
If we look at eating disorders, how does that tie in with how we're processing the hunger and not hunger you know, that change? So I think this is such an interesting area. And again, I love it because it shows the interconnectedness of emotions and physical health, which was always separated. You know, it was so frustrating working as a physiotherapist where people would present with pain and it would be like this messaging of, well, that's out of your scope because that's a psychologist. Yeah. And I'm like, I'm not going to, you know, disown emotions because, you know, and so these frameworks for me professionally have been like coming home. It's like, wow, now this all comes together. But like there was a study that came out last week, I think it was in the European Journal of Pain, and it actually showed how emotions are driving and amplifying pain, which I think people are like, but
right. Everybody kind of knows that on an intuitive level somewhere, but yeah, it's definitely not how we talk about it.
Exactly. But this is where I love seeing now the interconnectedness of, you know, say the vagus nerve running between the body and brain with the immune system, with the hormonal system, with the gut. Like it's connecting so much, and also around our emotional health. But even, you know, it might sound like it's sort of alternative, but the how our relationships are impacting on our health, because, you know, we have this social engagement system, part of the vagus nerve that runs from our heart up to our face. It involves speech, how we listen, how we express. And that is why other people are having a profound impact on us, and we are on them, which in turn impacts signals in our body, which changes interoception. You know, we can't have, we want to have this separation, but we can't.
You know, I think one of the first facts, I was definitely like very hyper independent, and, you know, I don't know that I necessarily would have said it, but I probably felt on some level for a really long time that being like dependent on other people for anything made you weak. And came across whatever research it was that babies who were being adequately fed and taken care of in every way except physical touch died. Oh. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? We literally need to be loved to live. This changes everything. It changes everything. Like, then it's out of my hands. You're not weak. You're just like, this is deeply wired and there is nothing we can do about it. We may as well get comfy with it, because holy crap, if that can happen, that's just nuts.
It's so true. There are actually, it's called like neurobiological expectations that are baby coming into the world will be held, will be touched, will be soothed. And that is what leads to development of certain areas of their brain. And it even myelinates that part of the vagus nerve. You know,
yes, it does.
So it's so like, I love what you're saying. Like, we try to be so hyper independent and look at wellness as like, it's just me doing my stretches, drinking my green smoothie. And it's like, it is so not about that. Like, I could go on about this all day, but, you know, wellness is not a solo act, and we all can play a part in improving the health of our communities at large, because that is taking care of our health as well, if our communities are healthy. So yes,
again, if we had all learned this in school, like, society would be structured so different. So many things would be different if this were honored genuinely in the structure of what we are doing.
I agree.
And also, I feel like outside of even just wellness, because for sure physical wellness approaches it this way, but even in the space of like a lot of coaching, spiritual, personal development, and sort of therapy world stuff, there is the idea that like, if you were confident enough, you would never need anyone ever to affirm or validate you. And nothing could be further from the truth. Literally, the only reason, you know, that like we ever develop a sense of self is having it reflected back to us as infants. So like the expectation that you could do any of this stuff in isolation is just absolutely the wrong direction.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I find it, the whole narrative went for so long to like, don't be codependent.
Like, which is so valuable, but like, can be taken. Yeah.
It's like, you know, so this is where I like to look at this, though, is we can have co-regulation. You know, this, we hear a lot about self-regulation, but co-regulation has shown that our heart rate variability will sink, different parts of our physiology will sink as we spend time together, but that we still have a connection to our sense of self. So we still have interoceptive awareness of what's happening with us when we're co-regulating. But with codependency, I think there's a loss of that inner world connection. You know, we're looking outwards for somebody to have that sense of safety. But again, this is like a lot of this is the social media messaging where we're putting super big complex topics into one little square.
100%.
And, you know, like the things that I've seen where now it's like, this is a trauma response. And I'm like, really? Really? Not really true.
Okay. So I feel like I haven't asked any of the questions I wanted, but what I'm just, because we're coming to the end here, I feel like it's really important to talk about neuroplasticity, because the whole point of this conversation is not, here's a bunch of reasons why your life might suck in these certain ways. It's, this is the reason, and you can do something about it. So tell me about the role that we can play in moving toward a healthy, flexible, happy nervous system, or however you want to put it. Like, what is it that we can do? What does that work look like?
All right. Let's, if we're going to look at it from the interoceptive perspective, and I think people will probably relate to, you know, sensations being too loud or too quiet, and that impacts on our emotional health, but also our physical health. We know that being able to connect to the body is a great way to change networks in the brain. So the insula is one section in the brain where these sensations come into our awareness. So as you connect to the body and you use the practice, this granularity with sensations in the moment, you know, of course we want to be trauma informed. We're not going to just pay attention if we're really, really flooded like that, that might not serve us the best, but beginning to be able to describe, first of all, what the sensations are without necessarily jumping to a generalized emotion, but then being able to sit with, well, what is this trying to tell me? So I really love that, passing a microphone to these bodily sensations. What do they want to say?
I like that.
You know,
too.
So it's like you're actually getting in there. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of the activation, if we go back to implicit memories, it's based on the brain's prediction. Now we think of like the brain, and we have a really heavy neuroscience message right now in our culture where it's all about, you know, neuroscience and changing the brain, and the body's forgotten a little bit. But the brain's really in the dark. It's up in the skull relying on these bodily sensations to tell us how things are. And the other part that is really interesting is that it doesn't optimize for happiness or rationality. It optimizes for survival, growth, and reproducing. So the way that it works so efficiently is by predictions. And I would invite anybody listening to this to think about it the next time they're stressed, to tap into the body, those sensations, what it's saying, but to recognize, well, does this feel familiar to something from my past?
Yeah.
You know, is there a narrative here that's coming back from something I learned previously?
Yeah.
Now, learning here is the key. That's neuroplasticity, where we're learning. So first we want to unlearn. And this is why I love the body for this, because we can stay anchored in the present moment. We can see the sensations, and we might be able to even see the narrative in our head of like, you know, things are hopeless, it's going to fail, or if I don't hurry and get it done now, things will fall apart. We can uncouple those predictions when we stay connected to present moment sensations and keep enough space for that awareness of what's happening in both the brain and the body.
Yeah.
And when we do that, where I spoke about the insula before, we can uncouple the way the insula and the fear circuitry communicate. Like, there's good science to show that. And we can actually train our interoceptive accuracy so that we're better at noticing the signals in our body without them being too loud or too quiet. And that really is how we proactively take care of our emotions, our nervous system.
Yeah.
But the third step, you know, we've gone sensation, emotion, it's action. So we can choose then, right, what action do I need to take that's in line with my values? And that's where I think this work is really powerful. So think of it as sensation, emotion, action.
I love that. I also feel like the hopelessness of like that, you know, powered down state, or just anybody who feels disconnected from their body. If somebody's like, you know, finds the sort of common wisdom to just like listen to your body, absolutely nonsensical because they have no idea what it means and can't do it. I feel like there's just a lot of people in this camp where the thought of taking action is like you're just missing so many steps in between. What fucking action are you taking? You're throwing a dart at a wall and just picking a random action. And like our brains are not super great at coming up with excellent self-care actions when we pick randomly, right? So like there is a reason that you end up feeling very poorly taken care of. You are taking poor care of yourself, not for lack of trying, but lack of information. So I love that that is the focus, is going in and getting the information you need to make good self-care decisions, whether that is emotional, physical, or otherwise. But like that to me, I feel like people don't even necessarily realize that they've sort of skipped a step, that there's like a train track missing, and that's why it's all going wrong, because we just don't talk about that being important information.
Exactly. And I think it's the foundation. You know, we can't, like so many people say to me, well, what's the one best exercise I can use to regulate my nervous system? And I'm like, well, there's not one, because it depends on what state you're in. It depends on what your bodily signals are and your information is. And that's where I think, you know, it is helpful to have to get help outside for sure. And like, you know, we've touched on that, but there's also a wisdom that only we have in our body that we can tap into and learn to make really great decisions from that. It's just being able to read those signals in a way that's helpful, and it will reshape our lives.
Absolutely. So for anybody who's listening, how would you recommend they begin this journey? If this is not something that they have a lot of exposure to, but they're hearing all this and they're like, holy shit, I think this is what I need. Where do you recommend they go? Or what do you recommend they start with?
I think the most helpful thing is to, from what you've heard today, is to get to know those three states. And you might say, can I imagine a time recently when I was in the hyper arousal, that fight or flight? What did I notice in my body? What were the thoughts? What urges were there?
Yeah.
You know, you like write it down, start to get like an understanding of that, and do the same for the state of collapse, dorsal vagal collapse, or when you're flat, and also do a state of what it's like to be in regulation. And then next to that, start to list what you already have to help you in those times. You know, it might be, well, when I'm really in fight or flight, movement is my go-to, you know, like going for a fast walk. If I'm really in collapse, it's reaching out to a friend, to even via text, if we can't do face-to-face yet. And if it's regulated, what helps me stay there? I think just beginning to build the awareness first, rather than go for the tool, come back to seeing the state first. And then that will be that foundation that we spoke about.
I love that. I also want to name, having done a lot of this work, my partner and I are polyamorous, and we did this together for the first time with each other. So I had never been in another polyamorous relationship. I hadn't any idea. I was very intellectually on board. I was like, I know this is what I want to do. I'm very interested and curious, but I have no idea how I'll respond. So my partner handles it, I don't know, magically, incredibly grounded. I don't even understand, since it wasn't necessarily like coming from his background of learning about it. He just like seemed to organically and intuitively handle it really well. When he had his first experience outside of the relationship, I had no cognitive story whatsoever. cognitively, I was like, I love this for you. This is so exciting. This is hot. This is like, I'm thrilled. But my body responded like I was, you know, trapped under a burning building or whatever. It was so intense. And I just can't even imagine how I would have handled that if I hadn't have been able to explain to him, this is, I am in a nervous system state right now. Like, I don't think or feel anything negatively about this situation, but I am panicking. And just to even be able to like share that, use that language, I'm so glad we already had that laid down, because I don't know what would have happened if I'd had to explain it as if it were something else. You know, it was literally at that point, just a very intense body reaction. And having him on board with that and understanding that and being able to like work with me through that was like, I don't know that I could have gotten through it otherwise, you know? So I feel like that is also one of the cool things that can happen as you get that information, is the story can kind of just piece out. You don't need the story when you're like able to really be like, oh, I'm just here and this is what this state needs. And we already know that about each other. So like, it's not that hard to tend to it, you know? Whereas if you get wrapped up in the story, it's very, very complicated.
And then it becomes so intellectualized, doesn't it? Around, yeah, this is right, this is wrong, or right, this is why I feel this way. And it goes back, yeah, to when I was this age and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But it's like connecting into the body to this is what I'm having happen now. And just narrating, yeah, your experience. I mean, I do this with my daughter all the time. It's like, oh, I can see that you're frustrated. You know,
yeah,
I,
yeah, yeah.
Feel that I want to rush in and fix for her when she's having a, yeah, difficult time, but it's not teaching her to be with what's happening, totally, for her. So it's really, oh, I can see that you're frustrated.
Yeah.
Oh, I wonder. And she's not very old, but it's, I think, exactly what you're saying, narrating, yeah, our experience, or even for that with somebody else, it gives that space again, instead of, yeah, trying to change somebody else's inner world, but even denying our own inner world. Like,
yeah,
I think that's why people stay in dysregulation, Jesse. Like, if you had of cut off from what was going on in your body and had this like rationalizing why, oh, you feel the way you feel, and then imagine the arguments that would come.
Exactly. That would have been horrible. Yeah, exactly. And I also just think there's something really, really lovely when other people are using this information to communicate with me. Like, I don't know that a lot of people in my life necessarily do it the same way, but like my therapist will do it. You know, she would never say like, I think you shouldn't do that, but she might name, I'm having a protective urge to tell you not to do that, right? It's like, we're really just dealing with the somatic information that has entered the room. And that to me feels so kind and respectful and like loving, as opposed to putting it into the cognitive where now I'm either going to get defensive because you told me to do something, or, you know, like it just takes it off into a different place. It doesn't need to go.
I agree. It's very refreshing.
Yeah. Okay. So tell me about the book you have coming out. When does it come out? What is it about? Who is it for? Where can we buy it?
So it's coming out in August, and it's called The Nervous System Reset. So it's so exciting to finally put together. Like, I've been on this path of learning more and more for the last 10 years, both as like a health professional, but then doing further study in that realm, and also times in my life where I've had dysregulation in the last 10 years. So personal parts of that, but it's really for everyone. So there is parts of it that are a little bit more complex for people who really want to nerd out, but we've kept it accessible for everybody, and it's available in all the bookstores. So for pre-sale now.
Awesome.
But yes, I'm really excited to have this come out in the world and share it with everybody.
I'm excited for you. I'm excited for everyone. And tell everybody who's listening, if they want to learn more, take any of your courses, like work with you, however, where can they find you?
Sure. So if you head to nervoussystemschool.com, we have two programs this year. We have our 8-week vagus nerve program. Again, that's a really good starting point for anybody who wants to learn more. And then we have our nervous system certification course later on in the year. And that's really for health practitioners, coaches, teachers, leaders, yoga teachers, first responders, Anybody who really wants to help the world become more nervous system informed and more trauma informed, it's a great way to implement this work into your organization, into communities at large, because as we've spoken about, there is a lack of understanding of the nervous system.
Oh, I love that. That's amazing. Thank you so much, Jessica. This was so excellent. I just want to name that I started my podcast as like a thing I could do. It was in the pandemic. I did solo episodes because I could get it done. And then at a certain point, I realized my favorite part of running my business, what had become my podcast, when I did like a couple of guest things here and there. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to follow this. All I want is to have interesting conversations with interesting people. This is a way I can just get that done and have that be a part of my life. It was purely selfish. And conversations like this are exactly what I crave. Like this is, I know how valuable this will be to everybody listening. I know how important these topics are, but it just like fuels my heart over here just to be able to unpack and nerd out such interesting stuff with you. So thank you so much for being here and sharing your wisdom.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I feel the same. I loved chatting with you and sharing this stuff and, you know, going back and forth. I can see we've got very similar views on the brain and body. So that excites me.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much for being here, everyone. Thank you so much for listening, and I will catch you on the next episode. Hey everyone, I'm Jessi Neeland, and I want to take a moment to thank you for listening to this episode of the This Is Not About Your Body podcast. I put out new episodes every Tuesday, so be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss it. And if you really enjoyed it, please go ahead and leave me a review. Also, if you're looking for more information about body neutrality or you want to work with me, you can find me at my website, jessineeland.com. Or you can just purchase my book, Body Neutral, A Revolutionary Guide to Overcoming Body Image Issues, wherever you buy books, ebooks, or audiobooks. We can also connect on Instagram or TikTok. My handle is Jessi Neeland. And because I make this podcast available for free and without any sponsors or ads, you can also feel free to show your support using the Patreon link in the show notes. And know that your support, if you decide to participate, is always very much appreciated. Lastly, thank you to my brother, Jason Neeland, for creating the music that plays at the beginning of the show. And thank you for listening, learning, and moving toward personal and collective body liberation.